Well, happy Easter, of course, and a blessed day. And, you know, if you've been around here a bit, you know that it's pretty regularly my observation that from a preaching standpoint, I always find the holidays a little bit of a challenge. And this is particularly true with reference to Sunday school. It's Easter, and you try and do something unusual. And so anyway, the answer to that is no. I'm not going to do anything unusual. What I am going to try and do this morning is a little bit of a mixed bag. I've just been taking some time since the first of the year to try and address some questions that have come in. All of them, of course, are theological in nature to one degree or another. We are giving now, this will be actually the sixth Sunday that we've given to talking about covenants. I was asked about the covenants. And there is one more coming. And as I've worked through things with the covenants, I've had conversations and questions that have come up with reference to those. And then I've just had a couple of other questions that perhaps should get some extended time, but I'm going to try and just work through them all this morning. So a little bit of a random collection of things. And I'm going to try and address the question as it came in and give an answer. And of course, if that raises a question, please always in Sunday school, feel free to interact, to raise a question right then and there. So, and so therefore, we're just going to be kind of all over the place with reference to the Bible and maybe a lot of more references than actually looking. So, okay. So we talked about the covenants in general and, you know, my standpoint, you know, our first covenant is the one with Noah, and then there is one with Abraham, which is really a covenant that its implications are broad, and then one with Moses, one with David, and then, of course, the new covenant. The Abrahamic covenant we saw is a covenant, first of all, to Abraham himself, and then to his immediate family, and then to the world at large. And so one of the conversations that I had right after I kind of worked through some of that was the extent to which the Abrahamic covenant applies to all the children of Israel. Because I pointed out that there is a progression. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had 12 children. They become the children of Israel, the sons of Israel. Israel's name is changed on his way back into the land, or Jacob's name is changed to Israel back in, as he goes back into the land. His 12 sons become than the inheritors of the land. I think it's pretty easy to see the extent to which the Abrahamic covenant applies to them, because part of the Abrahamic covenant is the promise of the land. They're the recipients of the land. The children of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, move into that land, and that becomes the land of Palestine, their home territory. But other parts of the Abrahamic covenant are fulfilled exclusively through one tribe of the 12. And so we don't want to miss that either. Jacob had, of course, 12 sons. When Jacob is an old man and getting ready to die, Genesis 49, you can read it. In what Hebrews tells us is a demonstration of his faith. He blesses his children and pronounces kind of their future role in things. And Judah is singled out as the tribe through which the king will come. And of course, then from that point on, while we recognize the Abrahamic covenant and its land fulfillment to the nation of Israel, the salvation, if you want to put it that way, I don't know if that's the best way, but the salvation dimension of that is going to be transmitted specifically through the tribe of Judah, which we can trace in our Bibles, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that Judah's sin in Genesis 38 is specifically highlighted. He wasn't the only immoral man, and his immorality did not necessarily surpass the immorality or morality of anybody else in his world. But Judah is the man who is going to be the physical line through which the Messiah comes. And so we are attentive to his offspring. And so, transmitted ultimately through Judah, David then is a member of the tribe of Judah. Jesus is a member of that tribe. And this is the reason why in the book of Hebrews, When the pastor talks to us at length about the Old Covenant and Melchizedek, he is specific to point out that there's no reference in the law to the priests coming through the tribe of Judah. They were all embodied in Levi. So there are various aspects to the fulfillment of that Abrahamic covenant. So all of the children of Israel inherit the land, and I'm going to return to the subject of the land in a little bit different question. But not all the children of Israel, not all the 12, they're all recipients of the blessing of salvation, but one tribe alone is singled out as the line through which the Messiah was come. Question number two, was Abraham a believer when God made the covenant with him? And the reasoning behind that was that I had argued that God wouldn't enter into covenants with unbelievers. And so I think my argument there, or my explanation, would be that the Bible portrays Abraham's departure from Ur of the Chaldees as the moment of his salvation. For instance, if you want to take a minute and turn to Hebrews chapter 11, right? In Genesis 12, it reads this way, "Now the Lord had said to Abraham." So there is some history that has happened in Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abraham. And here in Hebrews 11:8, is how I would understand to defend that, right? There is a moment of salvation, right? And we're going to spend some time with Abraham, and when we get turned back to the book of Hebrews, because Abraham is really a model of faith for two critical things with reference to the Christian life. One is salvation, but the other is lifestyle. And so Abraham was not simply a believer in the sense of being saved. He was a believer in the sense of living, and both of those are essential. But I think Hebrews 11:8 then helps us to the best that we can kind of nail down the sequence or the chronology here. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for inheritance, obeyed. Right? So he is being described as a man of faith at that moment. Now, when Paul talks about his faith in Romans chapters 3 and 4, right, he will demonstrate the faith of Abraham through Genesis chapter 15, because he's quoting Genesis 15. Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness, and that's what Paul will say. But I would be comfortable with saying that Abraham's departure from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land that God would show him was the moment, if I could import New Testament language backwards, is the moment when he got saved. And then the covenant comes to him when he is in the land. When he is in the land, now as a man who believes God, God enters into that covenant with him. And so, right, and you know, without, and I don't have the time and I don't want to get too far afield here, folks, but I would just point out to you that both Abraham and Paul, who are held up to us as models, I mean, this is not my language. The Bible holds both of these men up as examples to us about salvation and salvation by grace through faith. Of both of these men, right, the initial outreach is on God's part, not their part. And there's just that has to factor into the way that we think about this. We are not just down here floundering along in our own power, hoping that we can figure out a way to make the gospel palatable to people. but there is a God who is active in doing the work, not only of securing salvation through the Messiah, but in securing salvation by laboring among those who will be saved. All right, question number three. Jesus fulfilled the Mosaic covenant and the Davidic covenant, but what about the Abrahamic covenant? Did Jesus fulfill it as well? I think yes, in that ultimately, according to Galatians chapter 3, he is the seed. And so the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant are ultimately then fulfilled in him. Galatians 3:16. So, and I think that as we work our way through the book of Revelation, I think that we will see components of that. Certainly Jesus does not simply inherit a sliver of land as Israel is today, but the entirety of the earth. So anyway, yes, Jesus did, and we see again that unfold throughout prophetic history. Prophetic history, future prophecy. Question number four. If Jesus fulfilled the Abrahamic covenant, how are the land promises fulfilled in the millennium, which was a conjunction with is the Abrahamic covenant fulfilled in Christ? So the land portion of the Abrahamic covenant, folks, is, I think, biblically more significant than perhaps we recognize. And so the land portion of the Abrahamic covenant is to the Jewish nation specifically. And nothing that happens in the millennial kingdom is going to alter that, because all of the passages, or so many of the passages, let me back even farther away from that statement, the vast majority of passages, particularly in the Old Testament, that talk about the kingdom are talking about the kingdom that will exist within the confines of the boundaries of Israel as God defined them. And so I understand the Bible to teach, I am totally at peace with, during the kingdom, the land of Palestine will belong to the Jews, and that the 12 apostles will function as, all right, Jesus said they would be judges. And so they will function. This is probably an anemic equivalent, but they will function as a Supreme Court body in the land of Israel. And so I don't think that the fact that Jesus fulfills the Abrahamic covenant undoes that. And then there are other nations, and there will be other nations who will enjoy the blessings that are promised to them through the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, because part of the Abrahamic covenant is, in thee shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And so everybody, folks, to go back to the Abrahamic covenant, everybody, every human being is going to be related to God in one way or another through their relationship to the Abrahamic covenant. They will be Abraham's physical seed, and they will enjoy those components that are for the physical seed, or they will enjoy the blessings or the cursings by being part of everybody else in the earth, because God has chosen to relate all of us to his blessings and his cursings, to his salvation and to his condemnation through the mechanism of the Abrahamic covenant. Or I think, right, I mean, the Abrahamic covenant is God making promises to Abraham, but we don't want to forget that the critical component on Abraham's side was that he believed. In other words, folks, faith and faith alone is the great divider between men and between believers and unbelievers. It is not denominational claims or denominational labels. It is whether we believe. It is just simply that. It is whether or not we believe what God has told us. And again, we'll come back a little bit to the faith. And obviously we're at the lengthy passage. We won't deal with it this morning, but we're in a lengthy passage in Hebrews that is laying out for us the dimensions of faith. Question number five. You discussed several of the common beliefs about who the recipients of the new covenant are. And that, by the way, I think I made mention, I'm going to just tackle that all of next Sunday school in some depth. But to continue the question, you discussed several of the common beliefs about who the recipients of the new covenant are. Some believe that the new covenant is taken away from ethnic Israel and given to the church. Others believe that the new covenant is given to Israel, but only to believing Israelites. And what is the real difference between the two? So what is the difference to ask it this way, right? And what is the difference between a Baptist and a Presbyterian when it comes to our understanding of the new covenant? Well, there are a couple of components, but the big one, and I had already alluded to this, the big issue, folks, is land. The big issue is land. As a Baptist, as a dispensationalist, I would take the stance that there is still an ethnic Israel that has a place in God's program. That God is going to once again return His salvation attention to the nation of Israel as He turned His attention to the destruction of ethnic Israel. And that is really the primary thing being taught in Romans 9 through 11. And again, if I may just go off on this tangent, the primary function, folks, of Romans 9, 10, and 11 is not to teach us about election and foreknowledge and predestination and Calvinism. The primary point of Romans 9, 10, and 11 is to explain where we fit and where Israel fits in God's program of bringing the glorious good news to the world. That is its purpose. All of those other things become a part of it. But the purpose is to explain to us why we are here receiving the blessings of God now and what God plans to do with reference to the land of Israel in the future. I think if you back away from the theological component for just a couple of minutes and just look at the newspaper, but who gets a newspaper anymore, right? Getting a newspaper gives us away like having gray hair gives us away. With reference to our age. But if you will read the news in whatever source you read it, right, much of the conflict between Israel and its enemies, folks, is conflict over the land. They view the land, just the land, as incredibly important. And if you've ever been to Israel, folks, there are parts of it that are beautiful, but there's not much about the land that commends it. It's a desert. And I'm unaware that it sits upon vast reserves of oil. So, I mean, it's not like there's, you know, that it's great farming or great scenery or beautiful mountains, but it is highly prized land. It is the land that God designated and that He promised, and they want the land. And Palestinians want to exterminate the Israelites so they can have the land. And so the land is a critical distinction. When it comes back again to that, so what are the real differences between the two positions? That Israel, not as a nation, but as a nation of people who have a part in God's role. The promise is being taken away from them and transmitting them to us. Versus our position that God has a plan for future Israel. To me, the only answer to that is the land and how the land is thought of. We would argue that the church and Israel are not the same thing, but that's a component of the same argument. So I think there's still an ethnic Israel, and I think that the land promises to ethnic Israel. And here's one of the places where the difference shows up. Right? When you hear somebody call America a Christian nation, right, they're using Presbyterian theology. And I'm not trying to beat up on Presbyterians. I'm just saying, folks, that's the language that covenant theology would use. Because covenant theology now understands, right, there's been a promise of land made to Israel. They lost the promise. And therefore, land can be part of the Abrahamic covenant, any land. And this is part and parcel of their belief, folks, that what is going to happen is that the gospel is going to go out into all the world. And it is going to conquer. And it is going to prevail. And it is going to dominate land. And so they take a much more militant or militaristic view of the role of the church than a Baptist would. Because I don't think that anything that we do as a church is about conquering Nebraska for Jesus and turning Nebraska into a Christian state. Now, if everybody in Nebraska was a believer, that would be a glorious thing. I'm not arguing that. I'm just arguing that I can't go to Genesis chapter 12 and go, God promised Abraham land, and then go to the captivity and go, God took that land, and then go, now any land that I can conquer with the gospel is the land of the Abrahamic covenant, because the land of the Abrahamic covenant is very boundary specific. That would be the way that I would interpret it. That would be a reflection of my insistence upon biblical, about a literalistic reading of the scriptures. So I think the distinction is really ultimately about the land, because whether or not the church has replaced Israel, again, I don't have the time to get into that. I have other things to deal with. I'll talk about that later. But apart from this, folks, I want to be very serious and earnest about this. I do not embrace Presbyterian eschatology, but I have a tremendous amount of respect for the people, for most of the people that teach it, because some of them I don't think are as sincere, but that's also true of Baptists. And they have been a great blessing to Christianity, and many of them believe the gospel and live pure lives, and we just disagree on this. And again, I'll talk about that next week. What I'm going to do next week for Sunday school is steal a sermon from Mark Minnick. So there you have it, right? I'm going to tell you next Sunday. I'll even give you the date. You can get the sermon and listen to the good version, or you can just listen to mine. But that's Sunday school next week. Stealing a sermon from Mark Minnick. On question number 6. In the Old Testament, the Mosaic covenant, and thus its practices, was to be forever, as outlined in Leviticus 34, Genesis 17, 13, and Exodus 12, 17, for example. Since those permanent aspects of the covenant were fulfilled in Christ and made obsolete, why is it impossible that the land promises made to Abraham can't also be fulfilled in Christ, as all the world is given to him and those who are in him, Romans 4, 13, forever in the new heaven and the new earth? And again, without being any kind of a smart aleck, I don't know that I have a very clear, excellent answer to that. Apart from this, Bible texts do seem to indicate otherwise. They just seem to indicate the ongoing existence of a distinct land for Palestine. And they do this until, in the language of Jeremiah 31, 35 through 40, until the ordinances for the seasons and the sun and the moon go away. And they will go away. I mean, this is the argument that God made, or the promise that God made to Jeremiah to pass along to the nation of Israel, that as long as the sun rose and the sun set, and as long as the moon rose and the moon set, and as long as there were seasons, that Israel could understand that God had a plan for them forever. And Jeremiah was completely and totally content with that. But when we get to the book of Revelation, folks, we realize that there is a forever after forever. Turn, if you would, to Revelation 21. Revelation 21:1, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. Right? So right out of the box, we understand this. I mean, right now, about 70% of the earth's surface is covered with ocean, and John sees a planet, and there is no ocean. So, right, that is a radically altered world. Revelation 21:23. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten them, and the Lamb is the light thereof. so. Right? And Isaiah 65:17 says, this is, right? I mean, this is 800 or 900 years prior to the book of Revelation's writing. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind. I mean, God is very clear on this, folks, that He has a plan for the future that includes us, and we will never remember that we were here. It's not like we'll look back upon it and even shake our heads and go, I just can't believe that there was a time I lived on that planet. We will not even recall that it existed. That is what is coming. And yet, right, again, to go back to what I say, how do I answer that question definitively? What is the land? I mean, I'm reading it this way. What is the land in light of the Abrahamic covenant and the promise to land to Israel and Jesus fulfilling it, inheriting all the earth? What is land going to look like in that day? Well, there's a new heaven and new earth and no ocean and no sun. But then you read Revelation 21:24. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. So again, I'm not trying to be funny, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic. I don't know. I mean, here's Revelation. Now, you know, when I took a class on Revelation in Bible college, the professor got us to Revelation 21 and 22, and this is what he said. They're poetical. I have a poem that goes, there's going to be a new earth, and it's not going to have any ocean. And there's going to be a new earth, and it's not going to have any sun. But it is going to have nations and kings. There's a reason I was never a big fan of poetry. But that is the Bible story, folks, and that is the picture that is painted. So, no oceans, no sun, still kings, still nations. This is just way, 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 way beyond my skill set. So, question number seven. Since Jesus fulfilled the Mosaic covenant once and for all, how is it that there could be a return to the sacrificial system during the millennium? Especially, don't be laughing at me, Rick. I'll just deviate from Sunday school and start telling Rick stories. Since Jesus fulfilled the Mosaic covenant once and for all, how is it that there could be a return to the sacrificial system during the millennium, especially in light of all that Hebrews tells us about Christ's once-for-all sacrifice? Okay, so there's the question. All right, so this is, folks, in my mind, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the Achilles heel of the whole dispensational teaching. Because you just can't approach the Bible from the position of it being treated literally and of there being a real kingdom that lasts 1,000 years with real nations and a real Jesus who rules over it. And then go, well, all that stuff about a sacrificial system, he didn't really mean that. I can't do that. I can't do that. And so anybody who is, you know, trying to discredit dispensationalism, this is one of the things that they address, and rightfully so, because it is an issue. Okay? So here is my attempt at my own explanation and understanding of things. Ezekiel 40 through 48. Describe a temple that has no historical precedent. Now again, I'm going to approach those 9 chapters as describing something real. And some very good people just describe them as highly symbolic and representative. But I just struggle with that in an intellectual level. Why in the world would God take 9 chapters to give me explicit detail of measurements and directions and basically describing a set of blueprints when what he really means could have been said in a paragraph. So I would understand them as describing a literal building. Its dimensions are unparalleled. I mean, there's no place in the Old Testament to find anything like it. And as we read through Ezekiel 40 through 48, those nine chapters, we discover a priestly class, and we discover a sacrificial system. And so, I would just understand that to be a millennial temple that exists during, a temple that exists during the millennium that will be used as a place of worship for the Israelites. And I guess as I think through it, and I realize that I have an agenda because in every other place I am comfortable in my dispensational world. So I'm looking for a defense. The fact that Christ's work is finished is not really an obstacle, but makes it possible. To me, the great dilemma would be if we went back to that system because Christ's work was incomplete. It is true, and Hebrews is painting a very accurate picture of something we all treasure. Right? And I hope we do all treasure this, folks, that Christ accomplished all that needed to be accomplished for our salvation on the cross. Period. And that there are no more sacrifices to offer to gain His favor. But part of that explanation is this, folks. Nothing in those original sacrifices was designed to gain favor. Salvation has been always by faith, never by the works of the law. And so there is a very real sense in which even in the Old Testament, those sacrifices were emblematic. They represented the faithful response of people because that was what God told them to do. But the blood of those animals did not purchase their salvation. And in fact, turn back to Romans chapter 3. And verse number 25. Well, let's just go back to verse number 21. But now the righteousness of God without the law. Right? So we're going to take the law out of the picture and we're going to put on display the righteousness of God is manifested. Right? So we have a righteousness of God that exists without the law. And yet the law and the prophets, verse number 21, bear witness to the righteousness of God. They do not produce the righteousness of God. They just bear testimony to the righteousness of God. Because God's righteousness exists apart from the law. Even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all them that believe. There it is again, folks. Faith. Right? Faith is the great divide. Sinfulness is not the divide. Human righteousness is not the divide. Religion is not the divide. Faith is the divide. You believe or you don't. End of the conversation. You believe or you don't. And this is for everybody, verse number 22. There is no difference, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Part of our faith is believing our standing before God. Being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation. A theological word means He has eased God's anger. Because human sinfulness doesn't exist in a vacuum. God is furious with human sin and rebellion. In Jesus' substitutionary death, God's anger towards sinful men is appeased if they believe. Verse number 25, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood, to declare His righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God. In other words, folks, nothing that David did sacrificially had any bearing on his sin with Bathsheba, but the blood of Christ did. Nothing that Moses could do sacrificially could adequately appease God's anger at his murder of a man, but the blood of Christ did. So nothing in the law passed did anything other than demonstrate faithful obedience. That was all it did. So that, I mean, again, and it may be a seemingly very fine hair, but it is a hair. Why are you taking this animal to the priest to have it killed? I don't know. I'm hoping that this animal, you know, that this animal's righteousness will be good. And wrong answer. Why are you doing this? Because this is what God told me to do. And I believe God. Right answer. So, when we go back to that system, if I am right, and of course, I was talking to a pastor, literally an acquaintance, he's not a great friend, I was talking to a pastor acquaintance recently, and he called me an intellectual. And I just thought, I'm not sure if I'm insulted or flattered, but I'm really not flattered. And then I thought, if he knew me as well as my wife knows me, he would never call me an intellectual. Unless a synonym for intellectual is bonehead, and now to demonstrate that I'm not an intellectual, I forgot why I even began to mention that to you. I have completely lost my train of thought. I fail to see, and again I realize I have an agenda, but I fail to see what the harm would be in going back to a system that is simply portraying the work of Christ on the other side of the work of Christ. Traditionally, dispensationalists call this, they argue that it is memorial in nature. Oh, that's what I started saying. I believe that I'm right, but I'm not necessarily going to fight with you over I'm right on the whole dispensational position. The standard answer is that, yes, there's going to be a sacrificial system in an Old Testament temple during the millennium, and it's memorial in nature. I don't like that word, memorial. I much prefer the word testimonial. And we're going to get to this, folks, when we get to Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 6, right? Rather than bogged down in the academia of whether it's a literal thousand-year reign or not, let's back away from that and ask a little bit, what would be the purpose of it being one? Does anybody get anything out of it if there is one? And I just think that we shouldn't out of the box dismiss the idea that God is going to put on display for the entirety of the world what the system meant and how it should have functioned properly, which is something it never did. I mean, virtually the entire history of the nation of Israel is the corruption of the law of Moses, not the proper use of the law of Moses. So that would be my answer, and so that is what I think, and that would be my understanding. And again, that is the weak link in the chain, folks. It is the weak link in the chain. And so I'm into that. Okay, to change direction quickly, and here's what I'm going to do here. I got two more questions. I'm going to try and work them through them rather quickly. And then if I get further feedback on that, I may expand upon them. But these have nothing to do with covenants. These are two questions that have come. And so let me just deal with them. So question number 8, how does eternal security work? Or this question, does the sinner's prayer guarantee it? And the answer to that is no. Okay, immediately no. Just praying a prayer does not guarantee anybody's salvation. Okay? So I'm going to argue, as I've kind of argued from the book of Hebrews, that there are two components to what we call eternal security. Number one, eternal security exists because Jesus obtained an eternal redemption. He didn't buy anybody a short-term reprieve. He purchased an eternal redemption. Hebrews 5:9, being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. or Hebrews 9:15, for this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death for the redemption of transgressions that were under the First Testament, because the law of Moses, the First Testament, didn't cleanse any sins, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. So one side of eternal security is this. Jesus bought an eternal salvation. It's the only kind of salvation that he obtained. And I would put it this way, this is God's side of the equation. The second dimension to the equation is this, folks. For everything that God promises, or everything that God demands, he also includes a means to that end. This is not insignificant. We do not have the luxury of choosing our own pathway to God's promised end. Right? For instance, God's promised Abraham, you will have a son. Okay, I'll have a son by Hagar. No. You don't get to choose your own means to the end. I have an end, I promise the end, but I direct the means. Or, right, as Paul points out at length to the Corinthians, right, that for God's glory, in God's purpose, the means to the end of salvation is simply this: proclaim the gospel. Just proclaim the gospel. And that's the means to the end. And if people will not hear the gospel, just proclaim the gospel. That is the means to the end. So, all right? So with that in mind, right? And you can read about that. I'm not going to take the time to deal with it at length. 1 Corinthians 1:21 through 25, in which God through Paul is defending that position. The proclamation of the gospel is the means to salvation. The means that God uses, right? On the one hand, Jesus purchased an eternal redemption. The means that God uses is the faithfulness of his people in perpetuity, that they live lives of faithfulness. Hebrews, we will look at this in a little more detail. And we said the book of Hebrews, when we get into the section on faith, is actually giving us faith through three lenses. Okay? One is individual faith, individual events. So Noah, you build an ark. Nobody else gets told to build an ark. Abraham, you offer up your only begotten son. Nobody else gets told to offer up their only begotten son. Individual events, individual demonstrations of faith. That is one of the lenses of Hebrews. But another lens in Hebrews, folks, and probably the major lens within the book of Hebrews, is the ongoing life of faith in God's people as the means by which God will bring them to their eternal security. So you have all of these verses. Hebrews 3:6, Christ is a son over his own house, whose house are we, if we hold fast the confidence and rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end. Or Hebrews 3:14, we are made partakers of Christ, if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end. Or Hebrews 10:38, now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. So there are individual moments that are demonstrations of faith in our life, our own individual trials, and we, of course, zero right in on them, and Hebrews is dealing with them. But Hebrews is also painting another picture when it comes to faith, which is that our faithfulness to God over the course of our lives is an essential demonstration of our faith. It's not an option. It is one of the characteristics of eternal security. And the other one that is a little much more subtle, but nevertheless, I think, very real in the book of Hebrews, is the way that God uses the faithfulness of his people to perpetuate his message into future generations. And we will talk about that when we talk about the faith of Moses' parents and the way that their faith was instrumental in God advancing his agenda out into the future. Now, I'm not arguing here for any kind of sinlessness or anything like that. I'm simply making this argument that nature shows. I'm going to take the time to do this. I know we're a little bit late and I know it's Easter, but right, here's the point, folks. Over the course of time, nature shows, and we've walked through this, right? You're not saved, you can lose your salvation, you're saved anyway, even though you live like the devil. There's a guy who's got a website. His name is Bruce Gerenser. I don't think he would be offended. This is taken right off of his little blog. I read it periodically. Right? Here's his biography from his blog. Bruce Gerenser, 64, lives in rural Northwest Ohio with his wife of 43 years. He and his wife have 6 grown children and 13 grandchildren. Bruce pastored evangelical churches for 25 years in Ohio, Texas, and Michigan. He actually graduated from Midwestern Baptist College in Pontiac, Michigan. Bruce left the ministry in 2005, and in 2008 he left Christianity. Bruce is now a humanist and an atheist. So, never saved, still saved, saved and lost. Those are the options. Still saved, never saved, saved and lost. Those are the options. I think that the Bible supports clearly the idea that many people publicly proclaim this at the outset, and over the course of life, the demonstration is that they never really believed it. That, I think, is the clearest understanding of the parable of the sower. But, again, there's not universal agreement on that. Nature is going to show. It's not a demand for sinlessness. And as we've already seen, when we work our way through Hebrews chapter 11, there are lots of failures among people of faith. That is not what God is emphasizing. They had faith. That is what God is emphasizing. So, all right, and that leads me to question number 9, which I'm going to try and deal with very quickly. And the question is, how do you evangelize without quick prayerism? And I would just point out that biblical evangelism was never mechanical. It was never assembly line. It was never programmatic. It was never any of the devices and methodologies that fundamentalists have come to love. People must believe and they must confess. Romans 10:9, if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in thine heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believeth unto righteousness, with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. But, you know, and I, again, folks, and you know, you know the background I went to, and I'm not trying to trash my alma mater, but, you know, I just heard more times than I could count that we give an invitation because Jesus gave an invitation. Where do you give an invitation? Revelation, the Spirit and the Bride say, come. Jesus never gave an invitation like we give invitations. He never did. He never said, now, we're gonna bow our heads and we're gonna pray. And I'm going to say some words and you follow after me. I'm not arguing there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that there's not a clear model that that was done. People were commanded to believe. And part of the demonstration of their faith, their belief, was that they said they believed. And in the New Testament, that was accepted at face value. I've gotten to the place where I ask myself this question. What is successful evangelism? In the background that I came from, successful evangelism was lots of people responding positively to the message. When I preached the gospel, people got saved. That's it. And by the way, that is what happened in the book of Acts. But biblically, folks, I would argue that successful evangelism is not how many people respond, but how many people hear. Our task is to make sure that everybody hears. Our task is not to do whatever we have to do to make sure that everybody responds. Everybody has to hear. Paul says, Romans 15:19, through mighty signs and wonders by the power of the Spirit of God, so that from Jerusalem round about unto Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. Paul, are you successful? Yes, I preached. I preached. 1 Thessalonians 1:8, Paul commending the church at Thessalonica, for from you sounded out the word of the Lord, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place your faith to God word is spread abroad, so that we need not to speak anything. Were they successful? Yes. In what way? Everybody heard. Everybody heard. That is the sine qua non of successful evangelism. And I'm not going to take the time because I got 8 minutes left, but if you go to Acts chapter 8, the passage of the Ethiopian eunuch, you notice, folks, that there's no clear, right? Philip preached Jesus to him. He taught him the gospel. The man was reading in the book of Isaiah. But there is no programmatic approach to this. And again, to have ideas in mind, folks, to have these as essentials. When I became the pastor here, 1984, I took the church to the Romans Road, four things you need to know in order to be saved. You know, we did that all the time. And again, those are good things to know. But our urgency is to convey to people that they need to believe on Jesus Christ. And this is a matter of the heart, not simply a matter of getting them to respond in prayer. Okay, so I don't know whether I've been any help or not.